There are fewer than 30 men in the world qualified to drive Formula One. A mere half dozen, perhaps, to win. At this moment, I'm inclined to think you're not one of them.
No, you want to.
Keep up the good work, Stephen, and there you have it. There you go.
Hello, this is Desiree for F1Weekly.com. I'm your in-depth correspondent.
Let's go with the qualifying, Steve.
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Clark Rogers. I'm the host of the program. I'll be joined by Nasser Hamid, my co-host. This is podcast number 707, July 6th. 2016, Nasser.
Thank you, sir. I say takes two to tango, but Toto says it's all brainless.
On today's program, Hamilton booed, Rosberg screwed, and Verstappen on the podium, and we have part two of the Jean Surtees interview. Fantastic interview indeed, and of course, F1 Weekly now available on WROCK Radio, streaming on WLOR.net, Wednesdays at 11 p.m., and Saturdays at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And all I have to say is boo! Boo! But hilarious, hilarious.
Well, the booing was expected. CH was surrounded by mostly German-speaking people, even though this was Austria. So they are feeling for their homeboy, Mr. Rosberg. But man, what a race, what a Grand Prix. And
I have to admit, I was hoping that they would take both of themselves out and Verstappen would win. But unfortunately, my dreams never come true anymore since 2006.
Yes, and with Nando retiring, it may take even longer time. But you know what is interesting here? It started from his first pole, fifth season, but it was the first time he led going into the first corner. And I said, no, it cannot be. So I watched the first lap of the Spanish Grand Prix, and sure enough, it was Nico who had passed him on the outside. Very machismo pass in Barcelona, which did not last very long for both of them. What's your take on the thing? Whose side are you on?
I'm on Nico Rosberg's side, if you haven't figured that out. Not an LCH fan.
Fantastic. You know, the thing is, there was a lot of talk. Niki Lauda was pissed off. Toto Wolff was pissed off, and they're talking about this, they're talking about that. But you know what? I do not think that team orders will work, and I'm going to tell you why. If LCH gets the upper hand on Pretty Boy Floyd soon, which I think he will in after a few more races, barring any technical issues, then I think Nico with any team orders anyway. But if LCH is trailing by 10, 11 points as the season starts again second half, and he has already proven this. LCH is not somebody who's going to take team orders when he has a whisker of a chance to take the championship. This is not some guy who's going to, this, LCH is not Gerhard Berger who's going to win a championship. He never won, but if he was going to win, he can say, okay, I'm a nice guy, you can win now. This is not LCH makeup.
Oh, I absolutely agree. Not only that, but LCH, you know, he's not that happy of a camper because really, there's no other competition except for his teammate. I mean, even Sebastian Vettel and Ferrari aren't this year, and they're having bigger problems. It's sort of sad Red Bull is catching up, but nobody's really fighting with Mercedes. So the only fight we have is with LCH and Nico Rosberg. So I relish in any kind of fantastic crashing and banging and yelling and screaming. I mean, I love that last lap pass on Nico. It was great. It was wonderful. And this is what we need, because if not, it would be a pretty boring season. So I'm very, very happy. And sure enough, Rosberg had to take the penalty after busting up his car in qualifying. Lewis Hamilton, a great pole position. And of course, Nico Hülkenberg, because of the mixed up rain, dry conditions, Nico Hülkenberg actually does something fantastic and gets on the front row because Nico Rosberg has to take a gearbox penalty, which I don't like. I don't like any of these penalties. As far as I'm concerned, they could put brand new engines in every race. What difference does it make to the fans?
That's very true. But, you know, in the case of Nico and Lewis, you're right. They still at least half a second ahead of everybody. But Lewis has, Nico has one competition, that is Lewis, but Lewis has two competitors, Nico and Lewis Hamilton himself, with, you know, silly mistakes he made like in Kali in Azerbaijan. So these are the things I'm always afraid of about him. But the guy has, you know, even if he can make a few mistakes and throw off a win or two, and you can still win a championship. Let's put it this way. Do you think LCH can get a 25-point lead on Nico, and Nico fights back and takes over that and takes the lead in the championship?
That's, no, be honest with you, even with the mistakes, you know, like you said, barring some mechanical issues, you know, I still say it's Nico is a number two.
Yeah, he is. There's no question. You know, momentum going into Silverstone. This is Nico's latest problem, is definitely in Lewis's corner. And boy, if he wins in England, Nico will be under severe pressure. But I think Lewis is doing what I call a boa constrictor move on his teammates, slowly choking out his remaining world championship hopes. And who knows, if he wins his fourth championship this year, he may find a new sponsor in Mutual of Omaha.
Absolutely. No, I thought it was a great race. Rosberg had to start sixth because of the gearbox penalty, but he was up to third when he pitted on lap 11. Normally, pits usually go to the lead driver first, in this case being Hamilton, but Mercedes wanted to get Rosberg ahead of the two Ferraris. Hamilton pitted on lap 22, emerging behind Rosberg because of that slow stop. That was funny. I thought something, I saw a little powder by the gas tank on that one.
Yeah, and you know, as far as Nico's drive is concerned, it was very impressive drive, and he did not get into silly tangle as Lewis would when he's starting 6th or 7th. A very impressive performance from Nico Rosberg, no question. You know, he's more of a thinking man's driver, you know, like Alain Prost or a Niki Lauda, you know, where he can analyze what's happening, what it takes to win. It's not just brute speed all the time. It's just his bad luck, you know, that he has come into the team where they have the package, but the wrong teammate. And talking of his teammate, you know, with 46 Grand Prix wins, Lewis, there is a chance he may pass your hero, Le Professor, Mr. Prost, in second place with 51 victories by the time the season is over. And what an incredible feat that would be, Clark. Think about it. In 10 years, the driver has become the second most successful Grand Prix driver. And that should call for some kudos to LCH.
And his team.
Oh, of course.
No package, no delivery, monsieur.
Oh, yeah, just as Sebastian Vettel.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's been quite a while since we saw the finger and the big smile, and of course we would like to see
it's
that
back.
It's
not coming back.
Talking of Nico Rosberg, do you remember, and perhaps one of your favorites, a Burt Bacharach composition, a song called Anyone Who Had a Heart? And I think at Silverstone, Nico will be composing his own tune. Anyone who had a 43-point lead will know how I feel. There's still a lot of racing to do before the Arabian Night finale in Abu Dhabi, but I don't think it's looking too good for Keke's kid.
No, it's not. And real quickly, I want to apologize to the audience for our technical difficulties. We have some really ancient equipment that we're Skyping with are failing on us. So if you'd like to contribute to F1Weekly.com, just go to the front page and click the donate button on the left-hand side so we can get at least a couple $100 and buy a 10-year-old laptop. So there you have it. I just wanted to get that out. Now, my favorite part was on lap 27 when Sebastian Vettel was going down the start-finish straight, and kaboom!
Vettel going down.
Yeah, going down the start-finish line on lap 27 when the tire blew. That was his race. Bye-bye, Birdie.
Yeah, sadly, unlike Jean Alesi, there would be no Grand Prix victory on his 29th birthday. Instead of popping balloons, he had a Pirelli done blowed up. Everybody was expecting Seb and Ferrari to challenge this year, especially, you know, after last year. Things are so bad. Now, this will tell you how bad things have gone for Seb. They are so bad that even his teammate has not caught up to him in points. And that's just shocking. And I just hope, you know, that in the second half, they can mount a challenge. Seb has now failed to score in 3 of the 9 races so far this season. Apart from Sunday's event at Red Bull Ring, he also did not score in Sochi and Sakhir. But I don't think he's going to win a championship this year.
Well, the biggest problem is Fernando texted Vettel and said, you know, there are some bigger problems over here at Ferrari than just the drivers.
I think he's beginning to realize that.
Yes. I mean, it's really bad, when the team says they're working on the 2018 car.
That kind of surprised me. That what are they thinking, that Lewis is going to win in 2017 also?
Yes, obviously. So they're giving themselves more margin. So, you know, why say 2017 like Haas did? You know, let's say we're working on the 2018 car. That way, when Vettel is in his mid-30s, he might get another championship. No, right. Everybody wants to be at Mercedes. If you're going to win a championship in this decade, you need to be at Mercedes. I mean, Red Bull is not going to win a championship for quite a while, depending on what happens next year. But, you know, it's great stuff. But these cycles take a long time to get through, and we just have to relax.
Yeah, but they're not forever. I mean, you've seen it many times. And, you know, I keep thinking that if Nico becomes world champion, and if he wins fair and square, you know, more power to him. And you take the wins and championship as they come, fair or unfair. Really, it doesn't matter when you look at record books. But him winning the championship will be very good for the sport because, you know, he's fluent in many languages, very cultured, and, you know, does not operate the way a lot of people do. And one important thing is, if he gets invited by the royal family of Monaco, where he lives, at least he will not show up in Skechers lavender color flip-flop.
Yeah, but Nasser, I speak many languages. I'm cultured.
But that's why you have the big job as the host of F1 Weekly, a world-famous
correct,
podcast.
Correct, and I get free big gulps.
Yeah, and I was talking to my sister, and she asked me, how long have you been doing this? We've completed one decade. We've outlasted Renault Formula One Teams podcast. What else can I say?
Nothing. We've outlasted Flavio.
Yes. He got thrown out of F1. We are still there. We're still trying to get in.
I'm happy for Lewis Hamilton, and I was very, very happy for Max Verstappen on a great finish, keeping Kimi Raikkonen at bay. He's got a great future, and if Red Bull can pick it up a little bit by the end of this year, we might see maybe a few more Red Bull wins as long as Mercedes continues to make mistakes.
Yeah, and you know, talking about Max Verstappen, looks, you know that song, Me and Mrs. Jones, We Got a Thing Going On? It's like Max and Kimi's got a thing going on, you know? They're always seen together.
Yeah.
And but, you know, I'll tell you this thing, Max. He was voted driver of the race. This is the third time after Spain and Canada that he has been voted driver of the race. So anybody who thought this guy is a fluke or flash in the pan, this guy is there to win another race if Nico and Lewis take each other out. By the way, I don't think we've seen the last of this season.
Oh, absolutely. I hope not. It's the only fun I have left. That's it.
Yeah. Were you happy to see Jenson Button, our favorite Jenson Button, running second? And it was like a British 1-2 in the early going.
In the early going, yes, it was very exciting. And for a minute there, I thought Jenson Button, you know, was probably feeling like, you know, Braun GP again.
Or at least Bar Honda.
Yeah, no, I thought that was very exciting. And, you know, he's had a lot of experience with Honda. So he's hanging in there. Honda's hanging in there. Unfortunately, Honda came out saying that nobody wants their motor.
Yeah, that was very sad to hear. But how prophetic, huh?
Well, the funny thing is, Red Bull didn't want a Renault motor either.
Yeah, and the thing is, you know, the Jenson Button looked pretty good in second. And if you look at their times, yeah, sure, they're still over a second behind Mercedes. But boy, that's a lot better than being 6 seconds behind Mercedes.
Big shocker was how far down the grid, after being on the front row, Nico Hülkenberg wound up.
Yeah, Nico Hülkenberg, I don't know what's going on there. You know, now there is talk, and it's... I ran into a very famous journalist at the airport in London, and we were talking, and, you know, it was a personal conversation, so I said, okay, you know, we'll keep it personal, so I won't mention his name. And I asked him about who might go at Ferrari, and he said there are some names, and one of the names very high on the list is Sergio Perez, the media also, and also he may come with, you know, a $20 million check from Carlos Slim. Used to be in the Ferrari driver development program.
Correct.
So poor Nico Hülkenberg is going to get passed on that deal.
Not only that, but poor Dan, outdone by his young teammate, he's starting to feel the pinch. It's fascinating. But then, on the other hand, Daniel Ricciardo just signed a multi-year contract to stay in sound. But it all depends on what kind of package they have next year, because really this season is, once again, a Mercedes season. And unfortunately, the Ferrari wins that we had a few of last year are not going to materialize unless something very strange happens in the atmosphere.
Yeah, and then the cosmonauts in orbit, LCH and Nico, they have to do something to spice up the show. Like, you know, it would be great, you know, if one of them takes the other out blatantly, then in the next race, the other one takes out one of them blatantly, and then we can have a, you know, couple, 3-4 wins in a season for Max Verstappen.
That would be great. Now, I thought the really strange thing was Niki Lauda coming out saying that in Baku, Lewis Hamilton trashed his room, his driver's quarters, a la The Who 1970. What was that all about? Then he retracted the statement, a la Mercedes telling him to retract the statement when he called Lewis Hamilton a liar.
Well, you know, all of this was supposedly he appeared on Service TV network, which is owned by Red Bull. And I don't know what Red Bull put in his Red Bull drink. He said a few things, which he later said he did. That's not what he meant. But like, I just wait a few days, and then there comes the retraction and redaction, and then, okay, I didn't say this, a great guy. But I do know that Niki Lauda was a, and this is straight from Lewis Hamilton talking, was a big for get him to come to Mercedes. And having been a three-time, Niki Lauda knows a good driver when he sees one. So I don't think he's going to go and badmouth Lewis or anybody for that matter, unless he's talking about spaghetti culture.
Exactly. And spaghetti culture he knows and understands very, very well.
Yes, after all, this is the guy who test drove a Ferrari for the first time at Fiorano, and tell the guy who was there to translate to Enzo Ferrari, telling him, tell the old man, his car is a piece of caca.
Exactly. Keep up the good work, Nasser. Anyway, let's continue. We're short on time, Nasser. So if you want to go into some of your statistics and ranting and raving, please.
Yeah, you know, but one thing we don't want to shortchange is the wonderful performance by Pascal Wehrlein. His first championship points brought back memories of the late Jules Bianchi's drive in Monte Carlo, where the team, then known as Marussia, scored their first championship points. Pascal drove 40 laps on soft tires, and with a DTM championship behind him at the age of 20, he is looking good for a long career in Formula One. He is also in the good books of Toto Wolff. Without his support, the F1 drive would not have been possible. You know how they got the drive is they told Maynard that we'll give you a discount on the engines if you take Pascal, and then they negotiate what the discount will be. I think Pascal is in good hands. But he did screw up before the race even started by slotting his car in Felipe Massa's place and then reversing. And amazingly, there is no penalty, at least for now, for reversing on the starting grid. But there is if you reverse in the pit, which, you know, I have known for a long, long time, and just ask Arnage. And, you know, the one very impressive thing about this Lewis Hamilton victory, which got a lot of press, is this was 250th Grand Prix win by a British driver. Isn't that amazing?
It's just so amazing.
No, it is. There's no question. Because, you know, Britain has 10 world champions, and country that is second, joint second, would be Brazil with 3 world champions and Finland. So, I mean, they are head and shoulder and neck ahead of everybody else. But, you know, just take a look at a couple of wins. 46 for him, obviously. The first British Grand Prix winner was Mike Hawthorn at Reims, as you call it, and in 1953 over close finish over Juan Manuel Fangio. Arnage, 31 Grand Prix wins. First win came at Brands Hatch in 1985 for Williams, and I remember watching this race very early morning in California. Jackie Stewart, 3-time world champion, first win Monza 1965 at BRM. Dan Gurney was third in this race, and Jackie Stewart's last win was 1973 German Grand Prix at the Classic 14.2-mile long Nürburgring. Total victories 27. Jim Clark, one of the all-time greats, 25 victories, starting with Spa in 1962, also won the 1965 Indy 500. Damon Hill, 22 victories, part of only father-son combo to win Formula One World Championship. Pepito Graham won 14 Grand Prix races and is only man to also win Le Mans and 100, which he won in his first attempt. Sterling Moss, 6th level to win Formula One World Championship. His first victory came on home soil at Aintree over teammate Fangio, both driving for Mercedes. So Mercedes has been around the block and podium quite a few times. And JB, Mr. Brazier's favorite, 15 Grand Prix wins, first victory in 2006 at Hungaroring with Bar Honda, or maybe it was just Honda in those days. But I think the thing I will remember about Jenson Button was him winning Hungaroring before Lewis had his first win in the first year they were together as teammates at McLaren.
Of course,
do you remember
one of my
that,
favorites.
Sir? And you know, we're short on time, so just a quick look at some important historical races at the Austrian Grand Prix. Very first one was at an airfield at Zeltweg, 1964. Winner was Lorenzo Bandini of Italy in a Ferrari, and this is a poor soul who was killed in a very fiery accident at Monte Carlo in 1967. And then, of course, Roger Penske's only Grand Prix win came in 1976. With John Watson, and they mentioned over the TV, at least on the American network, NBC Sports, that he had promised Roger Penske that if he won the race, he will shave. He used to have a full-grown beard, and of course he kept his word. And Niki Lauda is the only Austrian driver to win his home Grand Prix. The great, one of my first Formula One favorite, Ronnie Peterson, he took his final victory here in 1978 before being tragically killed in the Italian Grand Prix at Monza. And of course, in 1982, Nikos Papito, Keke Rosberg, almost won the Austrian Grand Prix and had to finish very close second to Italian Elio De Angelis. And this is something that you can watch on YouTube. Highly recommend it. Shall we move on to Hape Dos, our favorite?
Yes.
Sure. Yeah, okay, well, I'll just give the result. Feature race won by Mitch Evans from New Zealand. Sprint race was won by... Actually, sprint race on Sunday was a case of Rule Britannia. Three English drivers, first, second, third. Jordan King was the winner over Oliver Rowland, and Alex Lynn was third. He is part of the Williams Driver Development Program. Do you remember Rafael Marcello, who was in the Ferrari Driver Development Program? Yeah, he is now leading the championship, I think a little too late, with 66 points. But Ferrari has already dropped him, so I don't know which way he's going. Now, young French driver, your homeboy, Pierre Gasly, is 8th in the championship with 47 points. His failure to win GP2 championship in his second year would mean Dr. Marcos Mascheri will fall on his neck, which may give another year at Toro Rosso to Daniel Kvyat. But no guarantees for Kvyat, no guarantees for Pierre Gasly. GP3, racer from Monaco, Charles Leclerc, was the winner, race one, at, of course, at the Red Bull Ring. Second race was won by Ralph Beauchamp. Charles Leclerc is leading the championship with 58 points. And Clark, I'm going to tell you something. Of all the drivers who are racing in GP2 and GP3 this year, we're talking about close to 45, 50 drivers. I seriously think Charles Leclerc has the best and fastest pedigree to become a professional Formula One driver. He is under the management of Nicolas Todd, and of course they know what they're doing. And would you believe this, Clark? The driver handpicked by Tony Stewart to be Haas's future talent, Haas F1's future talent and development driver, Mr. Santino Ferrucci, is 16th in this championship, 24 drivers with no points scored so far. Even more impressive, and with an equally impressive tally of points, is the young driver in the Ferrari driver development program, who is lying 22nd in the standings, Giuliano Alesi. At least Papa was a Rolling Stone with a lot of new motivation. Not sure what we have here. And finally, Formula E, Sebastian Buemi is the high voltage champion of 2015-2016 season, despite the best efforts of Lucas Di Grassi. And I think, Clark, that should do it. And we should now bring in Mr. John Surtees for part two of our conversation with him. And many thanks to him and his people, and of course, Mr. Peter Brazier, for making this a possibility.
Now, your move into motor racing was made possible due to contractual obligation placed on you by Count Agusta. Now, tell us a little bit about that background, where they did not want you to race other bikes.
Well, when I raced for Agusta, I also kept my own Norton machines, and at the beginning of the year and end of the year, I would finish my world championship year, and then I would come along and I would go to, say, Scarborough, Aintree, Silverstone, and ride my own machines. And the Italian newspapers said, Surtees doesn't need an MV Agusta to win. And Count Augusto got upset. He said, "No, non è possibile. It's not." And so, it's not. Well, the year before, and we're talking. So we're talking 58, end of 58. I had been with Mike Hawthorn, who had just won the world championship with Ferrari. Also, I was with Tony Vanderbilt, who had won the world championship with Vanwall, the constructors, and with Reg Parnell, who was team manager of Aston Martin. And that was there just after that meeting. And I said, no, I'm not interested in driving a car. I'm too concentrated on my motorcycling. When Mike had asked me, Rich Parnell invited me to test the Aston Martin. And I tested the Aston Martin and enjoyed it. And he offered me a contract. And I said, no. Tony Vanderbilt heard that I tested the Aston Martin, so he said, "Ah, you must test a Vanwall." And so I tested a Vanwall, and he offered me a contract. He said, "You start race with me, Formula One." I said, "You're not racing. You've retired." "Ah, but I'll start again." It's Tony Vanderbilt. So I said, "No, I'm motorcycling." But when I thought of that, when Augusta said this, I thought, "Well, isn't it? I quite enjoyed my time when I tried the four-wheel, I'd buy a car." So I went to buy a Cooper Formula 2 car. But when I was there, he asked me to be asked to introduce someone to me, and that person introduced himself as Ken Till.
Wow.
And told me that he had entered me for the March race at Goodwood, that he'd spoken and he'd got me a license, and that I should be there because they weren't going to have the car ready before to test it. But if I turn up on that day, I can drive a car. So I went there for the first day to a race meeting, and I saw a race meeting for the first time in car racing from a cockpit. I actually put it on pole.
Wow.
But had made a mistake in the race and went passing someone and went off onto the grass. But I came back and Jimmy Clark in the Lotus beat me. But after another race in that car and a race in my own car, two races in my own car, Colin Chapman rang me up and said, Colin Chapman came up to see me at Aintree because I'd just been first British car there, and said, "It's Formula One, John." So I said, "Well, I'm motorcycling." He said, "Oh, come and test." So I tested Formula One. He said, "I want you to drive for me." "Okay." I said, "Well, I can't. I'm motorcycling." "Well, drive for me when you're not motorcycling." So that's what I did. When I wasn't motorcycling, I went along and I did three or Grand Prix, I think. First one was Monaco. The gearbox failed. I think the second one...
Portugal, I believe.
The second one was probably Portugal.
Yeah.
And I put it on pole. And I was leading the race, and only the silly circumstances lost me the race because I was about 26 seconds in the lead. But I came back to England and I came second. So that was a start.
You know, some years ago I was talking to Jean-Pierre Beltoise, who raced motorcycles before.
Huh?
Jean-Pierre Beltoise, the
yes.
French driver. He raced motorcycles for many
That's
years.
Right.
And I asked him, what are the racing techniques which are different in two wheels to four wheels, and how big was the adjustment for him? And he said it's exactly the same. He had no problem. You were quick, whether you were driving two wheels or four wheels or a Formula One car first time. Did you feel any major changes in terms of driving techniques or racing techniques?
I had no problem in the speed. I was, as I say, I was as quick as anybody from the start, but I didn't have the experience to back up that speed. And that's what, whereas on the motorcycle you would start and you would have experience of people around you, you would know them and you would have experience of the other riders, so that you know which ones you trust, which ones you don't trust, etc. And that's always important in a race. And all of that you have to learn. So the fact is, what happens, the difference is, that when you start the other one, although you are quite capable, you are under more nervous tension because of all the facts you don't know. And that means that you have to do the learning curve in order to get that inner relaxation which comes with a little experience. The inner relaxation to where you're all very calm and collected, as against you're having to concentrate and be more stressful at the very beginning.
And you mentioned Colin Chapman. What was it like to work with him? And also there was a situation developing between either Chapman and Innes Ireland, and Jim Clark was also involved in that.
No, well, Jim Clark wasn't involved in it at all, really, apart from the fact that I chose Jim to be my teammate, because he'd been at Lotus before me, and I was a new boy. But Colin asked me for 1961 to be his team leader. And then that's when the problem with Innes Ireland started. And but, you know, Jimmy as such, you know, wasn't involved at all, because he was there and I'd said that, and it was just a case of when it all blew up, and I was probably a little too prompt. I probably felt a little too much, in a way, I suppose, some anger over the fact that a number of the racing fraternity hadn't liked very much my coming in and being so quick, so early, and getting these opportunities. And some of these included some journalists, and who had made it very uncomfortable, some of the things. And so I just walked away from it, whereas really, I should have been a little more like I approached my racing, a little less emotional. And it was a case of, I felt a little let down in that this was all offered around, and then I found out these other things about other contracts and things. No, because I liked Colin. I liked Colin, and we got on very well, the working, and we understood each other. And I think he did appreciate it, because he said, you know, without any experience, come along and lead the team.
And what was your working relationship and friendship off the track with Jim Clark?
Jim, fine. I mean, when I got married for the first time, Jim, I said, it's the only time in my life I will consider him as best man. because I had him along at my wedding, yeah.
That's good. Now, Colin Chapman, obviously...
Because it had been Jim who had, in a way, introduced that girl to me.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And Colin Chapman, along with Enzo Ferrari, two of the greatest names in the history of motor racing. What did you find? You worked with both of them in terms of where they were similar and where they were different in their approach to racing.
Oh, they're very different. No, they're very different. In that Colin Chapman, of course, had been more of a driver than Enzo had, and also was more technical. But from a point of view, probably of their, where they probably had a similarity was their aspirations for their mark. You know, Colin lived for Lotus, whereas Enzo lived for Ferrari, and that part of it, same. Down at the bottom of the end, the car side of it, the technical side and also the driving side, Colin would have been stronger with. But Enzo sort of was also obviously a very special... look, what would a Grand Prix be like today without a Ferrari?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Now, you know, your friend, Mr. Dan Gurney,
Dan, yes. Great guy.
Yeah, I was talking to him some years ago, and, you know, he drove for Enzo also, and I asked him about the Ferrari politics, and he said it did not affected him, or he did not feel much of it when he was driving for Ferrari. Now, in your case, you had some issue with the team manager, Eugenio Dragoni. What happened there?
Yeah, well, Dan was driving in a slightly different period, of course. You've got to remember that when Dan drove there, Enzo Ferrari, it was all sort of part of the old establishment. I mean, he went to race meetings as such, the same as his wife did, and he had a closer involvement. By the time I went there, with his son having died, etc., Enzo was no longer going to any races except practice at Monza. So, whereas before, he was first hand there and seeing for himself. He was only getting it second hand because you didn't have a lot of television or media except, okay, radio and such like. So you're relying on hearsay and what a journalist wrote. You also didn't have a situation where you had all the politics going on with Ford and Ferrari. Ferrari and Fiat, with Ferrari in the middle. So they were all the factors which led to my divorce and certain parties. It was something which the old man admitted was wrong, and which I also realise is wrong. And I think that rather like that time, perhaps, with Colin, that time with Ferrari is something where I should have found a different way of dealing with the situation which came up. Because it was wrong for him and wrong for me that we parted. Because we had the opportunity of at least two championships together, more. Because certainly we had the championship to be able to be won in 66, and certainly with the material we had, we could have won it in 67.
Now, another great character who worked for Ferrari was Mr. Carlo Chitti. Did you spend time working with him, or was he before your time?
Unfortunately.
You did?
I only worked with him once, for a short while. And that was when he was with Alfa Romeo.
Okay.
After I left Ferrari. The first time I didn't go to Ferrari, when they first asked me, was after I met Carlo Chitti for the first time, and he said about all the drivers they had and all the things they were going to do. And I thought, if you're going to have got all these drivers, you don't need me. So I didn't accept. After I left Ferrari, he asked me to come along and drive his sports car for him. So I carried out a test for him at the Alfa track, and I carried out some setting changes, etc., which made it much nicer for me to drive it and quicker. We went to Sebring to race, and I went out in practice, and I thought, this car doesn't feel the same. And I came back in, and I thought, oh, well, it's the same. But one of the mechanics said to me, no, Engineer Chitti told us to put it back to original. So in his own way, he was just testing me out.
Ah.
So I told him, forget it, and I left the track. I didn't drive. So that's my experience of Mr. Chitti.
Okay.
He was there. But still, that was an unfortunate experience.
Now, you mentioned Sebring, a fantastic facility in the U.S. Is this photo from, was in the other room? Is that a picture of Can-Am? Was that from Riverside?
Yes.
How much did you like American racing scene?
It's a good scene. I like the scene there. It's some good tracks. I understand that Riverside is now a housing estate.
Yeah, and probably in a shopping mall.
Yeah, shopping mall and things. I mean, that all had its real characters, quite different, you know, with a sand blowing across the track and all those things. But some good tracks in America, and the scene was what was also good. Can-Am was something which I found quite enjoyable. We did it with a very sort of personal way. It was just basically the van driver was also the chief mechanic and myself, and we went and raced in Can-Am. And we just got, and there was this local enthusiast who we had met who came along and helped us.
And you won the championship, right?
And we won the championship with that. Yes.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Okay, now earlier you mentioned...
It was nice working with a nice little team at a firm called Traco.
Oh, yeah.
Who prepared the engines, which was a Chevy, etc. No, it's... it's fine.
Now, earlier in our conversation, you mentioned if you could go back in time, and this is my favorite question to you. If you could go back in time and do a championship-winning season all over again, be it motorcycling or Formula One, which season was your favorite, or that you're most proud of, your accomplishments?
Would it either be motorcycling or cars?
Whichever you think was the biggest satisfaction challenge for you that you're most proud of.
I would choose 2 years.
Okay, we'll give you 2 years.
I would do 2 years. Well, on bikes, I would choose 57. Having won my first championship, I would have loved to have gone along and just followed it up with a second one. But they made some bad mistakes at Augusta, and I'd like to right those mistakes, you know, because they learned them afterwards and everything else. Also, the events of 1966, obviously I'd like to change.
Okay,
the number
great.
Of things which happened, we had so many stupid things. Apart from the Ferrari divorce, there was also some absolutely stupid things that lost me Grand Prix and lost me the championship. And I'd just like to put it right.
Put it right. A minute again. In terms of people you have raced against, you've raced, you know, against great legends, both on two wheels and four wheels. Let me put it this way. If you owned a motorcycle team, in the time you raced motorcycles, and you had to pick up two drivers as your team drivers, who would they be? And same thing for Formula One, from your Formula One days.
Well, if I go back in the motorcycling, of course, you've got to think of who the world champion was at the time.
Okay.
And who I was first able to beat with my Nortons, in fact, and that was Jeff Duke.
Yeah.
Jeff Duke was someone who was, you know, very special in motor racing. But there was a number of people who were there. You had, you know, both in the motorcycling, both British and Italian and German, in that I had people like Bob McIntyre, who was particularly special in the Isle of Man. There's Walter Zeller, the German driver, a rider on BMWs. John Hartle, who was in fact for a while a teammate of mine, etc. He was very special. There's a whole bunch of them who were good and good competitors and people doing it for the right reasons. The same thing's in a car racing. In my car racing, when I sort of first entered it, of course it was Jimmy who was there, and Jack, I've already mentioned. Jack was a great guy from the point of view of he achieved something which I wasn't able to achieve, which is he won a championship also in his own car. But he's a real trier. Jack would never gave up trying. Dan Gurney, probably with his ability, probably deserved some more success as such. You also got sort of Graham Hill, who was a great trier, a great person who always very steady and everything. Not the fastest of drivers out, but the fact is just the same, always someone who you'd be sure would put up a good race. So there's... a number of them. But as usual, you normally have a little group of 3-4 people there, and then a group of them all just below.
Yeah. Now, you had your team in Formula One. How challenging was being a team owner in Formula One? Very different than today, but still, I'm sure, quite a lot of work involved there.
Well, in a way, that's a bit of a sad time of my life, because we started, and we started on the basis of a mistake. I didn't intend to go into car racing, and possibly for John Surtees Limited, for John Surtees myself, driver, perhaps I should have just concentrated on making sure I sat my backside in the best possible car. But over some problems, I ended up with a Formula 5000 project. I had bought a 5000 project for another person who had asked me to do it for them, and I'd done it, and then they didn't proceed. So I was left holding this project of a Formula 5000 car. So we went along, we tested it and developed it, and that became the Surtees TS5, which raced in America. Sam Posey's and these people raced those. And I think we won the British Championship. It was very good. Then I had a year where I had two bad experiences. I made two of the worst mistakes that I'd done by the two teams I signed for in 1959. And at the end of that one, I said, no, I must look after myself. I'll do something. So having had the 5000 team, I had a team who was making these, in a place we had in Slough, decided to build a Formula One. So I built a Formula One in 1970, which was ready for the British Grand Prix. There's a possibility of us getting fourth place in that first race with it, but the big ends went. We had made a mistake on the oil tank. But from then onwards, it ended up with too much work for me as a driver and as a manager and a visitor of that and everything else. So my driving was reducing. So I did the testing of the cars, but I didn't do too much racing. But our cars were capable of putting up lap records in Grand Prix and of being on the podium. But we unfortunately ended up getting involved. The first time we thought we had a big sponsor, we got involved with a company who ended up not paying us. And that, we fought that over a period of about 3 years or so. But with legal and everything else costs, we had to stop and we had to accept our costs. But nothing else. And by that time it had made me ill. So I just had to stop the team. And that was the end of it.
Now, you mentioned earlier...
Now those cars only live. The cars which we still have, which are there, which is, you know, we won the European Championship with a Formula 2 car. So we have one of those, which I also won the Japanese Grand Prix with. But, and we have TS7, the first one we made. And we have some TS14s, which was the ones like... Mike Howard, etc., drove. And those we make work for the foundation.
How was Mike Howard in cars?
Oh, Mike Howard was good. Mike Howard was good. We saw Mike, he was having trouble with the cars, and we thought, well, it needs a motorcyclist to understand a motorcyclist, because Mike didn't pretend to have any sort of technical involvements or abilities. He just loved riding, driving, and doing all sorts of things. And so we came together, and he's a good, honest lad who always tried, and you could rely on.
Now, you mentioned earlier about the Henry Surtees Foundation. Will you please tell us a little bit about it and all the good work you are doing?
Well, foundation is one of those things, of course, which I wish I'd never seen because of the circumstances. But Henry, my son, who started karting at 8 years of age, did karts, into cars at 15, quite a successful time, Formula BMW, did a little bit of Formula Renault. And then we put him into Formula 2. And at a race, a series of circumstances all added up to the fact that he was in this race, and someone who was in front of him crashed, and the wheel came off and bounced over and hit him and killed him. And that was it. And so, you know, that was something which I suppose we'll never get over.
Yeah, but your foundation you have set up with your wife, and you folks are doing a great job in his memory. Tell us a little bit about the work of the foundation, please.
I thought of just walking away from motorsport entirely, but on the day of the foundation, the day of the service for him, we asked for donations instead of flowers for a charity that we knew in Tunbridge Wells relative to head injuries. And we got £34,000 given. And I thought, those people are doing this. I'll continue to work with Henry, and we'll form the foundation. So we form the foundation, and that's what we do. We work to create, and the people who work for me in my normal business all have to spend a bit of time on the foundation so that we keep costs to the very minimum. And we've been involved in projects which largely are all there to save time. Projects which are there to save time relative to injury and ill health. And so we've worked with air ambulance and some hospitals, all with equipment. We don't get involved in any expenses to anyone. We only get involved in equipment. We get involved in equipment for introducing blood transfusions and other things which save time. And we also have a project, which is why, perhaps I'm so busy as well at the moment, I went along and bought the kart circuit where Henry first drove a kart. And I hope to create a learning centre there to get youngsters from a community into some form of training so that they can have a career in engineering or perhaps even within the motorsport industry. Not to make drivers, but to give them a career based upon them getting emotionally involved. Just the same as I got emotionally involved when I had those spanners given me. Mm-hmm. And I worked on that bike. Sure. I think the same can apply. And I saw what it did with Henry. I think the same can apply to other youngsters in this community. And these days, I think it's vitally important that we get away from where people live entirely by the screen. And they also go along and put head and hands working in cooperation together their careers.
Yeah, no, it's very important. And now, in today's corporate culture of motorsports, which is so different from, you know, even 30 years ago, do you think we can have a racer down the road who can do a John Surtees and win a championship in MotoGP and Formula One?
Maybe. Who knows? Who knows? But only one thing's certain, and that is it can't be first.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm so proud that I'm here talking to the first.
Okay. That's only one thing, sir.
Yeah. You know, Britain has produced more world champion than any other nation, and you're involved with Racing Steps Foundation. Why is it that Britain has produced so many world champions? Is it because most of the teams are based here, or the Brits are just better drivers?
I think it's part of the fact that traditionally, of course, a lot has happened here. You know, motorsport going back has had. And since I suppose Tony Vandeveld went along and created that Vanwall car, which was followed by Lotus and Cooper, and the fact that the thing what started the motorsport industry at the higher level in this country, I believe, was the fact of Coventry Climax. Coventry Climax came along and produced an engine which was made available. That was followed up by Ford and the production of the Cosworth. And so on the basis of those two units, a whole industry was developed, which was very competitive, and it's just spread from there. And so it's all sort of ingrained in it. And going back into motorcycling, of course, you had this tremendous industry in this country. You had the Nortons, the AGSs, the Triumphs, the BSAs, all these people, Vincents. Sadly, you know, we only have one live one, really, which is Triumph now. But that was very much there, and I think that, that together with the sort of mentality as such all fits. And of course, the other thing which was really good was that we had quite a small island, but we had a lot of race circuits.
Oh, yeah.
We had a lot of race circuits, lots of little race circuits here, there, and everywhere. So there was an opportunity for people in small distances to be able to do a lot of racing on a lot of varied circuits. And that's very important, whereas when you go to the States, for instance, the distances one has to travel. Perhaps you just race here at Bridgehampton on the old days, you know, but then you have to travel a long way to go somewhere else.
Yeah, very true. Okay, sir, I'm very thankful for your time. It's very nice to see you. Finally, would you have a message to our listeners? We have a global listener base, quite a few in the UK. The gentleman is one of them. Would you like to say something to our listeners?
Well, the big thing is about life is that if one can go along and actually be able to go through life in doing something which largely you can be 100% involved in and love, then you're very privileged. So from that point of view, I feel that, you know, despite the hard days when it sort of started, which I didn't appreciate, it was just taken for natural. Back there with Mum and Dad and the sacrifices they made to get me started and etc. I've been, you know, very privileged to go through that situation. Made mistakes, etc. But I would just sort of like to say to them, please continue to enjoy your motorsport and to support it.
Thank you so much, yeah. And we are greatly honored to meet you.
Thank you, Nasser. John Surtees, thanks again for joining F1Weekly.com. There you have it, Nasser. I want to apologize to the forum guys. We just didn't have time with the Surtees interview to put the 50 words. So there you have it, Nas. Another outstanding job. Quick prediction for Silverstone?
A Mercedes driver is going to win this race. I think he's going to make the local fans very, very
exactly
happy.
And I predict that Fernando Alonso will actually finish the Grand Prix.
And Clark, I'm going to tell you where this racing championship will take a really mega turn when there is a race in the full wet, because I cannot see Nico even in the top three in the rain, because he's going to get blown away by Lewis, Sebastian Vettel, Daniel Ricciardo, and Alonso. These guys are very, very good in the wet.
Nas, thanks for that nice editorial. I want to thank everyone who listens. Good night.
Thank you.